Hello again. Thank you for listening to the Health and Happiness Program. I'm Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. We started the program 8 years ago to inform the Gallatin Valley and anybody in Montana or elsewhere on KGVM.org, or to listen here in the Valley on KGVM 95.9 FM. We deal with mental health issues and anything to improve health and happiness. We thank the Montana Psychological Association Public Education Committee for giving us their support. Now, Dr. Suzanne will present today's program.
Today and this evening, I'm here to tell you, do not take life for granted. That bite of fresh peach, telling your loved ones, I love you. We can't take our gifts for granted. We have with us today Vanessa Abraham, speech-language pathologist, to tell us why we can't take those simple things in life for granted. Welcome, Vanessa. Tell us what happened to you, dear. Welcome.
Yes, thank you for having me. This is such an honor to be here today. What a great introduction that, yes, we should not take life for granted. And that is, ironically, something I learned big time in my own medical journey, because I was a working mom, very independent, very, very healthy. You know, I would walk every day, everywhere. I had a toddler at the time, so I was very busy trying to keep up with her. We would hike. I would hike with her on my back. And then within a matter of days, if not, you know, maximum 1 week's time, I was on a ventilator and rushed to the ICU, where I was in the ICU for a month. So there was no indication on my radar whatsoever that I was going to go down and I was going to have the health impairment that I, and the diagnosis that I received within the matter of days. It was terribly scary for my family, and it's again proof that we just don't know what tomorrow will bring.
That's just incredible. And for our listeners, could you explain what a ventilator is and what it does and what the impact is?
Okay, so the ventilator was helping me breathe. So what happened to me was I was out camping, and I speak about this heavily in my book, Speechless. I was out camping, and I was fine. I went to bed one night, woke up the next day, and was feeling very tired, very nauseous. And as this week progressed, I started to lose my voice, which was very ironic as a speech pathologist. I couldn't talk. My voice became very hoarse, very breathy. I started getting a lot of pain in my upper body, and I just wasn't getting any better. And that was on a Monday morning when I started feeling sick. The following Sunday is when I was admitted to the ICU. Respiratory system was failing. They just didn't really know what was going on. They just knew that my body was slowly shutting down. I was unable to move the right side of my body. They were running tests, trying to figure out what was going on. They ran all sorts of tests. They thought maybe of Guillain-Barré, but they realized, you know what, no, her feet are okay. Long story short, it was a very rare variant of Guillain-Barré. I was left, as I said, I was on a ventilator. I used all modalities of communication, which is, again, ironic as a speech pathologist, as you know. I used gestures, I used eye gaze, I used text-to-speech. I used, low-tech augmentative communication devices, all the way to using a passive ear valve that helped me vocalize. So I have been on the journey of being the patient in the bed, which really taught me a lot about our field that I really wasn't aware of through grad school. Not that my grad school experience was bad by any means. It was phenomenal. But there's just certain things that you learn by being in the bed, experiencing what it's like to be nonverbal, experiencing what it's like to be the patient in the swallow chair, trying to figure out what's going on with your swallow, reading all the scans, and being told by the speech pathologist, look, we're still keeping you NPO. Your swallow is still not improving. and having those conversations of we need to have a pig put in. So it just really opened my eyes to the medical side of speech pathology, and not only that, but the after effects of a communication disorder and what it's like trying to recover mentally and physically from communication disorders, swallowing disorders.
Absolutely. Could you, for those out there who aren't familiar with what a ventilator is, describe how that is done, what that is, where it goes, kind of give them an inside view of being on a ventilator first, please.
So it's terribly scary. And I think probably, for me at least, my particular experience being on a ventilator, because I'm a speech pathologist and I knew what that entailed, I knew that patients that are admitted to the ICU that need a ventilator, they are extreme severe cases. And for me, that just exacerbated the fear and the anxiety of me, because I knew that I'm not only in the ICU, I'm on a ventilator, it's keep helping me breathe, but I'm also tube fed. I'm also not able to communicate right now. And my anxiety was through the roof the entire time. I knew that, okay, I'm in the ICU, I have a speech pathologist in my room, I have a PT in my room, I have an OT in my room, and I have about 3 to 4 other individuals in my room assessing me with white coats on. This is not good. And again, I think a lot of that is because I'm an SLP. I'm not a medical-based SLP. I do work in a school setting, so I didn't really have that significant of a background in the medical side of it all. But I do work in the school setting where I'm very familiar with augmentative communication devices. And I realized when I was in there, too, that, wow, I need AAC. I need text-to-speech. I need something to communicate and be able to advocate for myself, and I don't have that. And again, my anxiety, my team had to keep giving me anxiety medications because I was so scared, so fearful of what was going on around me, and I couldn't advocate. So now I'm very, very, very passionate about AAC in the hospital setting, giving patients a form of communication so they can ask those questions, so they can be involved in their care, because I didn't have that. I did have that. But when I was unable to communicate, when I was intubated, I would be sweating, I would be furious, I'd be angry, because I had questions. I was very aware of what was going on. I wanted to know about my child. I wanted to know what my prognosis was. And I couldn't ask those questions. All I could do was just stare at them. And that caused anxiety.
Not just anxiety to me, total terrifying fear. You know, like, what's going to happen? Where's my baby? A toddler, you know, and a mama, they're hard to separate. And here you are. And so the ventilator goes into the oral cavity or the mouth and down the throat and prevents any speech. So you can look at people, but you can't talk to them. And you have no means to communicate. Am I getting that right?
Absolutely. I was nonverbal. There was a point in time that the only way I could talk or communicate my needs was by blinking. And blinking my eyes, looking at letter boards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so this is like what we were going to talk about today. I mean, the medical aspects are just amazing here. All of this technology wasn't even available a few years back, and it's keeping you alive. But the impact of suddenly your whole entire life changing, and like you said, being surrounded by medical personnel, and not knowing exactly what's going on, and not being able to ask the questions you want to ask, the psychological impact here is just almost beyond enormous, isn't it? Oh.
Yes, absolutely beyond enormous. And again, that's one of those things that when I was a grad student, nobody really talked about what psychological recovery looked like from an ICU stay. The brain fog, the cognitive dysfunction, the depression, the anxiety. And that brings me to a whole nother conversation about post-intensive care syndrome, or PICS, P-I-C-S. And that's another area that I'm very passionate about educating, not only SLPs, but anybody working in the medical field, what post-intensive care syndrome looks like, that feels like, because it's something that I have suffered from and many ICU survivors deal with. We get out of ICU, and obviously, yes, I'm very grateful to be alive. I'm so grateful for my team, and I talk about that in my book, Speechless, about how grateful I am for what they did for me. But there's this other component that, yes, they send you home from ICU, you're alive. But then, okay, take me for example. I wasn't able to work for a year. I wasn't able to drive a car. I was tube fed. I was severely depressed, experiencing suicidal ideation, confused, angry, very anxious, you know, with the thought of having to go back into another MRI or seeing an ambulance causes anxiety, causes those sweats, those panic attacks. Oftentimes, ICU survivors, they can't sleep through the night because of anxiety, PTSD. So there's a lot of components to recovery that we're not talking about. When I left ICU, nobody says, hey, Vanessa, you're going to need mental health services. You are a young mom. You're not able to take your child to school anymore. You're not able to drive. I went out and tried to find mental health services after I got out of the ICU. And one lady tried to, after seeing me walk through the door, very frail and tube fed, tried to provide therapy for me for a eating disorder, when what I really had was an eating or swallowing disorder.
Yeah.
I couldn't safely swallow. You know that. I could not. I was tube fed. But she wanted to put me in a support group for individuals with an eating disorder. And I was so heartbroken, so
she
angry.
She didn't get it at all.
She didn't get it at all. And I just thought, wow, how many patients leave the ICU tube fed with swallowing impairments, and people don't know how to treat these people? They don't know that there's a difference between eating and swallowing disorder.
Well, and I do have something to that. It turns out that about 5 to 8 out of every 10 people who receive ICU treatment develop PICS, and it's something people don't know about. You know, post-ICU, after you've been through all that, it just would make common sense that it would be entirely and totally traumatic. Oh, my goodness.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's similar to coming home from war. We have that post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah.
Our lives are completely turned upside down. We have sensory experiences. Smells may trigger us, sights, textures. I have a friend that was in, had to go back into a medical procedure recently. And she goes, Vanessa, just being in here and seeing the white walls and the floor and the smells of the medical establishment that she had to go back to was just triggering, and she had to walk out. She goes, the smell is making me so uncomfortable. And I said, yep, that totally makes sense to me, because that's where trauma happened. And the same thing applies to children. Children can experience PICS too. PICS, it's an adverse childhood experience, an ACE. It's very traumatizing for children, too, and we really need to be having those conversations with the parents that are in the ICU as well. Letting them know that when your loved one gets out of the ICU, they may be experiencing brain fog, depression, anxiety. And here's some things to look for. Here's some resources to help them. Instead of, like me, just sending the patient home and expecting them to navigate it on their own.
Unbelievable. Yeah, the symptoms of PIC are anxiety, depression, grief, insomnia, PTSD, and stress. And so here's a person that's totally mentally undergoing some of the most difficult feelings to work through. And what do? You say, good luck. Out the door.
Yep.
We did everything you need. Oh, goodness. Goodness.
Yeah, it's really, really sad. You know, the medical establishments, they do their job when they're there in that acute setting, and then they send you home. I'll never forget it, too, is when I came home, my medical insurance shipped me all sorts of medical supplies. So things like shower chairs and walkers, you know, those medical supplies that you need to function, which I was very appreciative. They sent me all the medical equipment for cleaning my PEG tube and all the cartons of food, which was great. But I remember looking at it and just thinking, what good is all of that equipment when right now in my head I'm trying to figure out a way to end my life? What good is all of that equipment? And they didn't even think to say, here's a medical provider that can understand medical trauma. They sent me all this other equipment when I just sat there on the couch thinking, if I could just get into my car right now and drive it off a cliff, this would all be over. Oh, but instead, they sent me all this medical equipment to try to keep me alive, which was great, but they totally overlooked the mental component of recovery.
It sounds depressing just to see that stuff come through the door.
It was very depressing. The carton, the cases, they sent me six cases. It was probably 5 or 6 feet tall in my kitchen of cartons of tube feed. And I just looked at that thinking, yuck, I'm going to be tube fed. Is this my forever? If this is my forever, that I'm going to be the mom sitting on this couch unable to get to the toilet by herself and tube fed, this is not the life I want to live. Help me figure out a way to end this. I don't want that tube feed. I don't want that shower chair. I don't want that suction device in my bedroom for the rest of my life.
Thank you so much for sharing this, because I know there are people out there who are experiencing this now, or those who will, and what you're pointing out is don't give up. And I was this medical SLP and worked with many, many swallowing patients, and they would come to me at the facilities after having been in the hospital and maybe with a recently placed PEG tube. And the depression and the shock was just written all over them. And I remember that my biggest job was to get them to believe that we could do something about that. And I remember one gentleman who was 98 years old and had just turned his face to the wall and decided, I just, like you said, don't want to be here anymore. And Diane and I, my cohort, said, get up, Harry, come on. And to make the long story short, we got him back off that PEG tube, and he got to go back home and live in a beautiful apartment in a very nice senior facility to live independently again. And so what I'd like to point out in the midst of this great horror and difficulty of being put into that situation is don't give up. Stick with the SLPs and we'll get you there. And there's so much reason for hope. And you're pointing that out for us, Vanessa.
Absolutely. Your body, the beauty of neuroplasticity, and you understand this, my body has changed so much since when I got out of ICU, and I had no hope. I was hopeless. I was the poster child for not having any hope that this was the rest of my life. And I've learned that, you know, your body wants to heal. You've got to give it the time. You've got to do the therapies. You've got to get to the gym. You've got to work for it. It's not easy. Trust me. I've been down the road. I've wanted to give up. And I just kept working.
Were you able to find any counselor, therapist, psychologist that was helpful?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that's a great question. I have since, the person that actually educated me on PICS, which I'm so terribly, extremely grateful for, that she looked at me and said, Vanessa, I think you have PICS, referred me to a support group that is specifically for PICS. And there's actually a couple of them that I attend. They have weekly support groups, and they have been the best source of knowledge for me about what I'm experiencing, but also community. Community, I've been able to find a community of other people experiencing this that are survivors that understand what I've gone through. Whereas most people would just say, well, you survived, be grateful. Wow, look what you've done. I've been able to find a community that I can go to and just say, hey, look, I'm experiencing these residuals, and they understand me, they get me. So that's been really wonderful. So some of the support groups, there's one in Vanderbilt, one in UPMC Mercy in Pittsburgh. So they have been very, very, very helpful. And I recommend them to everybody I come in contact with now, just so people know that they're not alone. There are supports out there. What you're experiencing is real. This is not something that, you know, a lot of people want to discount and say, oh, well, you survived. You know, you should be grateful, like I said before, but I don't know. It's just something that I'm very passionate about now, is getting people to come to these support groups too, because truly when I started to go to them, I really felt like, here's a group that understands me.
Which is so, so therapeutic. And, you know, it's interesting. I think PICS is kind of a recent diagnosis that many medical professionals are not aware of. And in fact, when I was looking into this, I only found 3 articles about PICS in the medical review. It's like people don't know. Even medical professionals, as you've noted, don't understand. And so your platform, and I'm proud that Vanessa had a recent article in the American Speech and Hearing magazine about this experience, trying to let people know, hey, there's a lot more to this than you ever imagined. Yeah.
Yeah, most people don't know. I've spoken to groups of people many times since my own medical journey, and they just look at me and they say, wow, thank you for talking about this. Now I know that I'm not alone and what I'm experiencing is real. And as you were saying too, that people don't know about it, there is not an ICD code for PICS. I work with a team of individuals that are working really hard to get an ICD code for that. Hopefully in 2026, we'll see some changes so there can be some billing and research done on PICS. So you know, you're going to start hearing more about it in the years to come. But you're right, there's not a lot of awareness about it. And I'm trying to do as much as I can to spread awareness right now and educate people.
I found out recently, I do veterans evaluations, and one 81-year-old veteran had heart surgery and came out with memory problems. And that was how it was referred to me, just as memory problem. It turns out that he has, similar to what you have, in fact, maybe the same thing with a somewhat different name, is a post-operative syndrome of some sort, in which memory is an issue. Not memory problems all the time, but intermittently in this case, but enough that it is embarrassing to him, or it keeps him from doing things he would otherwise want to do. And then I looked for the diagnostic code. There wasn't one. So I had to give a different code and try to explain how that was the closest thing I could find. So, yeah, that's very interesting. I hope they, in fact, compensate him. You never know what the VA panel will do, but hopefully they will help him.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, interesting story.
When you said brain fog, that's been used with COVID-19 by even some of our relatives who, post-COVID, a few years, talk about long COVID or brain fog. How did it affect you, the brain fog?
You know, I didn't experience the brain fog as much, but I know many, many people that do experience the brain fog. For me, my significant ones were anxiety, depression. Those were a level 10 out of 10. And then secondary to that would be just the PTSD, the flashbacks, some of the insomnia too, of waking up in the middle of the night. When I was in the ICU, I had a lot of terrible, scary things happen to me in the middle of the night. So I think my body just kind of remembers that. So it's hard for me to sleep soundly through the night now. But I think, as I mentioned before, too, seeing ambulances, I had 3 different ambulance rides, hallucinating in one of them. So they weren't very, I don't have very fond memories of ambulances. So for me to see an ambulance, for me to go back into a medical establishment and be in a room where there's MRI machines or the beeping of noises, sounds of ventilators, those are big triggers for me as well. But I didn't really have like the cognitive, the memory loss, you know, just the executive functioning component of planning, organizing thoughts, executive you know, task completion. I think if anything, I've gone into like hyper mode in those areas where now I'm not comfortable being still in my body. Now for me to be still and present, I get really uncomfortable because I feel like I always have to be doing something now. And I think that's just part of the PTSD or just me just not being comfortable being still, if that makes any sense.
No.
It sounds similar to hypervigilance that many PTSD survivors have.
Yes, very hypervigilant. That's the perfect word for it. That is me. And as I said too before, just the depression. I'm so much better now. I'm 6 years out. But those first couple years, and then I was recovering during COVID too, where we weren't supposed to be socializing, going back into, yes, exactly. So I kind of, my illness was in 2019, kind of 2020 is when things, you know, with the pandemic came out. So I was recovering during that period. And so it was just a period of like 2, 3, 4 years or so that were just upside down for me. And that's where the depression was just off the charts.
What about the effect on your family, your caretakers?
Oh, that was, and that added to my guilt. I felt guilty that I couldn't be the mom that I wanted to be. I couldn't drive my child around, couldn't hold her. There was a long period of time where she lived with my parents because I just couldn't, you know, children, they have a lot of energy. While I was napping a lot, I was exhausted. I was physically impaired. I couldn't hold her. I just couldn't be the mom that I'd always envisioned myself to be. So it was really, really hard. My parents stepped up and they really helped out significantly. My husband was off work for approximately 6 months or so, which was a gift that he was able to do that and then go back to his own job. But it was hard. It was really hard. And it was hard on them navigating, you know, my depression and my anxiety that I was experiencing. It has not been an easy job on any of us, but you know, as you said before too, just having that hope and fighting, I got to the point where I was just so desperate to get better that I thought, okay, you know, I need to write a book. I need to use my experience to educate other people. And really my book launched almost a year ago in January of 2025. And it's really shifted my perspective on what I've experienced, and it's really given me purpose. And, you know, doing what I'm doing right now and just trying to educate people has really lifted my spirit significantly.
Could you perhaps give us the name of your book and how one could order it right now?
Yeah, so the book is called Speechless, How Speech Therapists Lost Her Ability to Speak and Her Silent Struggle to Reclaim Her Voice in Life. And it's on Amazon, so you can just go on Amazon and you can type in Speechless or my name, Speechless Vanessa Abraham, and it'll pop up. It's a blue cover with pink lips on it, and the title came from being a speech pathologist that was unable to talk, and that was me. You know, I just, everything, as I mentioned before, from eye gaze to passing ear valve.
I wanted to clarify for the audience, we've talked about how you had something down your throat, you couldn't speak, you couldn't breathe on your own, but there was further interruption to normal processes. Since you couldn't eat, they placed a PEG tube. And this is something I've worked with so much. Describe what a PEG tube is for the audience, please, Vanessa.
Yeah, so my PEG tube was a tube that was put into my stomach for feeding because my swallowing muscles were paralyzed and I couldn't safely swallow food. So my husband had to tube feed me, and that was another area that caused immense depression, grief, because I knew that, oh, now he's got to be the one feeding me every day.
Through the PEG tube from a bag hanging that was full of white stuff that you couldn't even taste. So there you were. So this insult to what we all take for granted is so huge here, and we want to congratulate you on hanging in there.
Absolutely.
That's beyond amazing, Vanessa.
Yeah, it's been a very, very hard journey. But, you know, my family got me through it, and I kept fighting for my daughter, too. I wanted her to have the mom that she deserved. And I said before, too, now I really want to use my experience to educate medical providers, you know, and even respiratory therapists, social workers, and therapists. You know, I mentioned before I was treated for an eating disorder. I was also treated. I went to a mental health therapist about a year ago and told them, I said, you know, I suffer from this thing called PICS. Have you heard of it? And the therapist said, yeah, I have. And I was really shocked because usually people say no. Well, it turns out she thought I was talking about pica.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and she goes, oh, I thought you had pica. I said, no, PICS, post-intensive care syndrome. And she goes, okay, I've never heard of that. And I said, well, I figured. And I was heartbroken again. And I just thought in my head, you know what, Vanessa, you really need to speak about this. You really need to educate people so the next person that's in your shoes doesn't experience this heartache and grief and sorrow when they try to go out and get health, mental health services for PICS.
And, you know, I think we just need to keep on with this effort to educate people, but also about being on a PEG tube and how not being able to eat orally impacts so much of our lives, because mealtimes are our social times. Sitting down for breakfast or lunch or dinner doesn't happen when you're on a PEG tube. I remember this was a lot of my work. I remember working with about a 50-year-old woman who'd been on a PEG tube for 9 years. And we did a swallow study, a modified barium swallow study, and found there was an avenue, albeit quite complex, to start perhaps thinking about eating orally again. And we did several months of exercises and preparation. And I remember being able to plan after her next modified barium swallow study, her first oral intake, her first meal after all of this. And it was so great fun. I went to her favorite Mexican restaurant and got her favorite meal. Of course, I had to puree it, but Mexican flavors stayed the same. And for her to be able to have that meal again, and eventually then to get off the PEG tube and back to eating, that's something that I probably enjoyed almost as much as she did. And so what I'd like to do is encourage people out there to consider the field of speech pathology. It's really great to be able to help people come back. And here we have Vanessa teaching us how to help people come back. And the thing about that lady, too, was because she couldn't eat orally, she didn't go to meals in the facility. And when she got to come back for her first meal a while later, everyone in that room clapped and cheered, and tears were everywhere. So it's a social thing as well as an intake problem. Yeah.
Absolutely. What a beautiful story. And I can relate to that so much. I remember sitting on the couch while my family sat around the dinner table and all ate together. And like you said, they were social and engaging in each other socially. And Vanessa sat on the couch just staring at a wall, broken inside, depressed, thinking, again, if I'm not going to be able to sit at the table with my child over the years and have Christmas dinner with her or share Thanksgiving dinner with her, why do I want to be here? Terribly depressing. Terribly depressing. So your story, oh, that's just beautiful. And it reminds me, too, of my speech pathologist that got me eating again and how appreciative I am of her and her hard work that she put into helping me get back to eating with my family. That was a big game changer in my own recovery, too, because I was tube fed for 4 months or so, 5 months. And then when I was finally able to have that tube removed, which another anxiety-provoking moment.
Oh, yeah.
Because I thought if this tube is removed, what happens if I can't eat orally? What happens if I regress? and then it's going to have to be put back in. You know, my mind just would fly out of control. And I just remember being so appreciative of her, of that she got me back to that point of eating orally, but then there was that fear of what if, what if, what
another if. Deep psychological rift that many professionals aren't aware. Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, of course that's terrifying. I mean, people out there, I want you to know that the food way where you swallow is right next to the airway where you choke. And it's very frightening, and it's a very complex process to swallow again. Very complex. And of course, we really need to congratulate Vanessa for even achieving that.
And you know what was interesting, too, that I remember when I had mine removed, the doctor just pulled it out, no big deal, and was very like nonchalant about it. And I remember thinking at the time, he has no idea how anxiety-provoking this procedure is for me. And he just pulled it out like it was no big deal, like he's just going for a walk in the park and he's going to pull this plug out and just go about his day. Meanwhile, inside for me, my hands were sweating. I was having like these little panic attacks. My body was getting hot. I was so nervous about it. And little did he know what was going on in my headspace. He was just like, no big deal. Just another day.
This is so scary. I'm sitting here just terrified thinking about it, Vanessa.
Uh-huh. And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. And part of me didn't even want to have it removed because I was so scared. Like, if this is removed, what happens? And I was eating orally for a solid month before it was removed. But still, that fear was still there that if this is removed and I can't eat, I'm going to either die or I'm going to have to get put back in. And your mind just, oh.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know other stories about being a speech pathologist that people might want to consider this field. I remember I was referred to treat a lady because she was in a wheelchair and through a neurological condition, her head was bent over and her chin typically rested on her chest. And her oral intake or her eating was terribly interrupted thereby because the food could fall out of her mouth because her head is looking down at her lap. And she's been this way for several years. And I remember the handyman at that medical facility helped me, and we created posts on either side of her wheelchair, and then we put a headband between the posts that would go around her head and hold her head up during meals. And it was just amazing because she's not going to lose weight now, she can eat. But what really impacted her the most surprised me, and I shouldn't have been surprised. She now had eye contact with everyone around her.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Her communication was so enhanced because previously she's speaking to her lap, and just the change for her was magnificent.
I have goosebumps. And you know what that probably did for her, too? It probably relieved some depression that she was experiencing because she actually could see and look in her loved one's eyes. Oh, wow.
May I say that I also worked in some of these facilities, and I observed some of these devices that Suzanne would improvise. So I'll compliment her for that as well. In fact, I don't know how many you had made, but there were a number of them.
It was just that you have this incentive when you see a person to help figure out what would work. And Vanessa, somehow you navigated through all of that. And what's equally impressive is you navigated through the psychological devastation that was occurring daily, hourly.
Yeah, that was, again, something that nobody talks about in graduate schools to their clinicians that are going out into their externships. I think that's something that's really missed.
Has that changed any? I assume with your, I would hope you do speaking engagements or conventions or, and of course your book, where there would be a, people who are learning that what they need to know. Or I'm sure you're very active in that. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And it's honestly, it's changed. Yeah, I speak about it, but it's changed how I do my work with students now in the school setting. The first thing I'm always looking at is mental health. What is going on with this child mentally? Are they experiencing any anxiety, depression? Because truly, if, like I said before, if your mental health is not being addressed properly and you are suicidal, you're anxious, how are you ever going to make progress in your therapy sessions? And that was me. I would go to my speech therapy sessions, my PT, OT, and I'd be just sitting there crying, so depressed. And what good is the therapy session if you're so profoundly depressed? You're not going to make the progress that you could be if you had more hope and more motivation to get better. So it's really transformed how I approach my career as a speech pathologist. I thought I was trauma-informed before. No, I truly wasn't. I will admit that fully, that I thought I was a trauma-informed, but now that I've lived it, I've been that patient in bed that experienced it, I am more trauma-informed than ever.
Oh, boy. Yeah. It's incredible how that could be overlooked. It's hard to understand how that could mm-hmm. be just dismissed or bypassed or not noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Here mm-hmm. you are crying, but instead of addressing that, they're just continuing with rote therapy techniques that are helpful and did get mm-hmm. you back. But in the meantime, if you give up, and I'm sure there are those who don't have your strength, Vanessa, and who give yeah. up during the process.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I would hope that your insurance company stayed supportive. We hear so many stories about denials and red tape, and hopefully they were a good one. Were they?
Yeah, they were. I didn't experience a lot of that, no. And my support groups, I didn't have to go through insurance for any of that. So I got really lucky insurance-wise. But I've heard horror stories. Oh, yes, they're out there.
You know, I just wanted to, for some reason, mention that when oral intake or eating is down and difficult, I did something with my patients that anyone out there could do that would really help them regain nutrition along with this, because at the same time that you're battling just being able to swallow and eat, you have to have good nutrition in order to get back there. So there was a little item called BenaCalorie, and you can order it online. It's BenaCalorie. And it's a little container, an ounce and a half. The thing contains 300 calories. 309, I believe. So, and it's just a little paste, and it has no flavor. So you can add it to anything. And what I did was add it to a milkshake and mix it in a 6-ounce cup. And in that 1 6-ounce cup, I could get 600 calories. So what that would do when somebody was having difficulty swallowing was allow for great nutrition. Two of those a day was 1,200 calories. And they could do as many as needed. You could add it with other things, but the ice cream really packed in the calories. Also, sweet is one of the last flavors we really can taste and enjoy, and cold stimulates a swallow. So it has all kinds of wonderful attributes. So anybody out there undergoing any of these things could look at enhancing nutrition along the way, as well as the exercises and the intake efforts.
Yeah, that fear of not consuming enough calories is another fear. Another source of anxiety that I lost so much weight and I needed to gain weight back.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a real hard time because I couldn't eat orally. So my husband was actually making some tofu. He'd blend things up and put olive oil, just some high-calorie substances through my tube, mm-hmm. Just so I could get 2,000 calories, 2,500 calories, you know, mm-hmm. 3,000 calories. He was just trying whatever he could do to just get good quality fats in me, good calories, because that was another concern that, oh, she's not getting enough calories. How can we beef this up? So,
and you know, I would submit here that that heroic husband, whom I already dearly love, also had PTSD throughout this, and also had some depression and fear, and had to deal with a lot also.
Yep, and that brings up another conversation of Pick's family. That is another conversation, but that is real. Family members go through their own grieving process, their own anxiety. You know, they're grieving too, the loss of their previous loved one, of who they were, and going through an acceptance process too of, okay, this is who they are now, and how do I move forward? A lot of care, you know, they're going through the caregiving process that they may not be able to work themselves because they're now a full-time caregiver. My husband went from working full-time to not working as well and being a caregiver, helping his wife get in the shower. And yeah, their lives changed significantly as well. And that's another conversation that needs to happen when patients are discharged from the hospital, of not only saying, look, your loved one may be experiencing this, but you, as a caregiver, you're going to be going through this too. And it's important for them also to have those conversations with a mental health therapist. And it's okay. It's normal.
Yes. And I think, you know, what we're talking about today is that you can come through these difficult times and you can get better. And your family can recover, but we just need to be prepared, all of us, to recognize the psychological underpinnings of this huge and epic journey that you've had to take.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can get better. It's just, it's not an easy road, but you can. You've got to fight. Don't give up. There's supports out there.
Have you had much feedback from your book or the article that was written?
Oh, yes, yes, lots of great feedback. Now, like I said, it's almost been out a year, which is hard to believe, but a lot of good feedback. There's a university in Florida that's using it as part of their curriculum, which is huge. And I'm just hoping to get, you know, to continue speaking about it in the years to come.
Well, not just continue, enhance, improve, put into the curriculum. Maybe we should join together, all of us, and make a concerted effort to talk to Asha about making this absolutely, substantially a part of what we do.
Yeah, I think it should be part of mandatory coursework in the universities, honestly. I think it's overlooked. I know they have a lot of information to teach, don't get me wrong. But having, you know, even if it's just 1 week, one chapter of understanding PICS, that would really transform patient care.
And talking about referrals to the appropriate psychological care and working mm-hmm. closely with psychologists and counselors to use their expertise to help through mm-hmm. PTSD. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Are there any upcoming events that you could advertise right now that perhaps if someone wanted to speak with you or hear you?
Yeah, actually, it's funny that you mentioned that because in January I'm doing a three-part workshop. There'll be a social worker there as well as a nurse. We're doing a three-part where we're all going to be talking all things medical trauma related and PICS. So that's going to be on, there's three different Thursdays in the month of January, and you can actually go to my website to gain information on that, or follow me on Instagram, which is my Instagram handle is speechless_SLP, and there's QR codes on there that you can register, and gain more information about PICS and medical trauma.
And that would be, could you repeat again how people would click onto that?
Okay, so you can go to Instagram, and my Instagram is speechless_SLP. And then there's also a Facebook that you can find me, Speechless SLP. And Speechless, again, is my book. So an SLP is speech language pathologist. So there's information on there that you can go to, scan the QR code and register. It's going to be a very informative workshop with three of us. So I'm really looking forward to that.
So it's online then, yes?
Yes, yes. It'll be a virtual three-day workshop.
Powerful. Oh, good thing. Yeah. Yeah, it's a... it's a good start toward education. Have mm-hmm. you thought about working with groups of physicians? I know you're working with SLPs, but what about physicians and psychologists and counselors, that group who also should be attending to this?
Yes, absolutely. All of the above, respiratory therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, you name it. They all need to hear this. They all work with patients.
Excellent. Excellent. I keep reviewing your experience with them where they didn't seem to understand that you were suicidal as they were instructing you what to do next. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's sad. And it happens. Happens too often.
Here in Montana, we have, unfortunately, the highest suicide rate in the nation, and I work with a group called Help Center that receives a lot of calls, and I'm sure many of the calls have to do with, of course, anxiety, depression, PTSD, and people who are coming out of medical events or still in them. So this is very helpful to the audience that we're talking to right now here in the Gallatin Valley, Bozeman, Montana, where they know that people like yourself who've been through the negative experience, the catastrophic experience, can really talk about it and know that there is hope for them to be able to come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have to take any psychotropics to help?
Yes, I did for a couple of years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. one thing I see recommended in the literature, that medical support through prescriptions can help alleviate the stress, depression, and...
absolutely, the anxiety as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, there's a time and a place for it all, and yeah, it's real.
As we get toward the end of the program, Vanessa, what have we missed, or what else would you like to tell us about this whole process and this whole... interestingly, catastrophically sad portion of your life?
You know, we covered so much. You know, I think the ultimate message is just don't give up, please. There's so much help out there. It takes a lot of work and research to find the right help, but there's, you can always go to my Instagram, and there's so much information on my Instagram. Just know that you're not alone when you're going through these journeys, and there's help out there, and just keep fighting, please. Yeah, that's my big, because I was there. I was hopeless. I was a speechless SLP. I went through it, and the depression's real, and there's people out there that care, so just don't give up.
And remember, Harry, 99 years old, had given up, but...
yeah.
He got off that peg tube, and it's not necessarily age-related. It's just mm-mm. related to not giving up, just like Vanessa said.
Yeah, keep fighting. Keep fighting. Keep putting one foot in front of the next, and just get out of bed. And as you said it too at the very beginning, you know, you never know what tomorrow is going to be, and we've got to find a way to be grateful for what we're given every day.
This has been an amazing program. Thank you so much for the information. I'm so sorry about what you had to go through. The positive outcome is that you have helped so many others and have given resources and ways, methods and techniques that people can begin to reach out and change. You mentioned your support group, which is terrific. And I would hope in your Instagram, are there listing there where you mentioned three or four support groups. Are there any others that you thought of?
No, those are the big ones. I know there's probably a couple more out there. Again, there's not a lot of information out there. There's not a lot of support, just because this is a conversation that hasn't been had before. But know that just because there's a little bit of, you know, not very many support groups out there, there are support groups out there that they will reach out to you at any point in time and offer support. So again, you're just not alone out there.
Thank you again, and we hope that the people in Gallatin Valley will be able to, many of you will be able to listen to this, give feedback. I know that you can help others around you, and perhaps in some cases reach out to Vanessa and maybe start a support group for a similar condition. Thank you for listening. This program airs on at 9 o'clock on Thursday morning, 7 o'clock on Monday evenings. And we'll see you at the next time. Thank you.
Thank you.